this decision or Tennessee's law, there is nothing that they could craft in policy that would make trans people vanish. We have been here since, you know, the early 1900s and before, and we will continue to be here regardless of the policies that they push against us.
Good. I hope so.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Okay.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon, where they probably heard some shaking today, felt some shaking today on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. It's on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com. Love you, Nicole. Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brant Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, as ever. And since an hour or two before airtime today, there were reports of both a 7.0 magnitude earthquake up in Northern California and a tsunami warning for millions of folks along the West Coast. And since we heard from a few folks here right afterward, hoping that we were okay and safe from any tsunami, for example, our friend Susan used to go as For Earth over on Facebook, wanted to make sure. Actually, she wanted to make sure you were okay, Desi Doyen. Did you notice that? She
yes.
said, Desi, I hope you're not in the path of the tsunami.
Yes, and I said, I am not. So anyway,
well, what about me? Desi is okay, as am I. We'll just say that right off the bat, because we're in fact in Southern California, didn't feel a thing, and are far enough away from the coast in any event that even if we did get hit by a monster tsunami here, I think we'd be perfectly safe here. Am I right about that, Des?
That's my understanding.
We'll find out anyway. I will share a few more details about the earthquake and the tsunami, the warning for which has now been called off. All is well, and the damage was very little, reportedly, in Northern California and into Oregon, where we've got a lot of listeners. But we'll have more on that in a little bit, along with Desi Doyen's latest Green News report. But as I've got a guest standing by, let me talk about something completely different to kick things off today. During its Wednesday hearing on a high-profile Republican culture war battle case, the Supreme Court's corrupted right-wing majority seemed likely to uphold Tennessee's big government ban on gender-affirming care for minors, according to most media outlet coverage since then. The justice's decision, not expected for several months, could affect similarly cruel laws enacted by another 25 states around the country, controlled largely by Republicans, playing along with the years-long, largely Fox News-generated political issue and a range of other efforts to regulate and control the lives of transgender people, including which sports they may compete in and which bathrooms they may use. The case is being weighed by a right-wing dominated court after a presidential election in which Donald Trump and his allies promised to roll back protections for transgender people. The Biden administration's top Supreme Court lawyer, Solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger, warned a decision favorable to Tennessee in this very specific case, known as SB 1, could be used to justify nationwide, yes, big government restrictions on transgender health care for minors in the future, say in the upcoming Trump administration, despite years of claims by Republicans, at least when they were fighting against allowing health care coverage for millions of Americans during the debate over the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, that the federal government had no business coming between patients and their doctors. Well, that was then. This is now. Those were the days. Apparently long gone now, it seems, after the 2022 Dobbs decision granted the right for states to ban the right to abortion, even in cases where doctors found it to be medically necessary. And now, as the high court weighs whether states and perhaps even the federal government may ban medically necessary and doctor-recommended care for transgender individuals, first minors, despite approval by both doctors and parents, and then, of course, anyone else that Republicans controlling state and federal governments wish to control the lives of. In arguments that lasted about 2.5 hours on Wednesday, five of the six right-wing self-declared conservative justices voiced varying degrees of skepticism of arguments made by the Biden administration and by Chase Strangio, the ACLU lawyer who was representing the private plaintiffs in the case, the Tennessee families challenging the state's big government ban on their own decisions with their own doctors to look out for the needs of their own children. Tennessee, it seems, has decided that, well, the government there knows better than either the parents or the doctors. Chief Justice John Roberts, who with Trump appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch, surprisingly voted with the court's liberals back in 2020 in a case in favor of transgender rights, seemed to question on Wednesday, according to AP, whether judges, rather than lawmakers, not doctors or medical professionals, I guess, should be weighing in on questions of regulating medical procedures. Quote, the Constitution leaves that question to the people's representatives rather than to nine people, none of whom is a doctor, Roberts said in an exchange with Strangio. The court's three liberal justices seemed firmly on the side of the challengers, but it's not clear that any of the so-called conservatives will go along. Justice Sonia Sotomayor pushed back against the assertion that the democratic process would be the best way to address objections to the law, you know, letting people, I guess, vote on it or vote the representatives into office who will then vote on it. Sotomayor cited a history of laws discriminating against others, noting that transgender people make up less than 1% of the U.S. population, according to studies. She said, quote, blacks were a much larger part of the population, and it did not protect them, speaking of the democratic process. She added in her colloquy with Tennessee's Solicitor General Matt Rice that, quote, it didn't protect women for whole centuries. But sure, never mind protecting rights. Let's leave it up to the voters which people have their rights protected, even if those voters have been easily turned against the tiny minority of the public via a right-wing takeover of our media, our social media, our public airwaves. And no matter how cruel the results of this actual policy is, in Tennessee, as I say, it's called Senate Bill 1 or SB 1, the cruelty of which is summarized at least somewhat in this comment to the court on Wednesday by the Biden administration's Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preliger.
I think the court should think about the real-world consequences of laws like SB 1. Consider its effects on Ryan Roe. As Justice Sotomayor noted, Ryan's gender dysphoria was so severe that he was throwing up before school every day. He thought about going mute because his voice caused him so much distress. And Ryan has told the courts that getting these medications after a careful consultation process with his doctors and his parents has saved his life. His parents say he's now thriving, but Tennessee has come in and categorically cut off access to Ryan's care, and they say this is about protecting adolescent health, but this law harms Ryan's health and the health of all other transgender adolescents for whom these medications are a necessity. And the state says it doesn't even want the courts to take a look at whether this protects adolescent health, but the reason Ryan can't have these medications is because of his birth sex, and a sex-based line like that can't stand on rational basis review.
The U.S. Supreme Court faced an easy case in some ways on Wednesday when it heard oral arguments in U.S. v. Scrimeti. According to Chris Geidner in his Law Dork newsletter on Wednesday night, after he spent the day in the courtroom witnessing the much longer than scheduled hearing, the question, he writes, does Tennessee's law that bans transgender minors categorically from receiving gender-affirming medical care in the form of puberty blockers or hormone therapy, does it classify based on sex? It does, Solicitor General Preliger explained repeatedly in representing the view of the Biden administration. But from reading a lot of coverage of the hearing in the corporate media, it would seem that the argument was not over whether the lower Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals properly heard the challenge to Tennessee's law in the first place when they upheld the law, and whether it should be or not should be remanded back to that court to be reheard. That seems like the case, what the case was, should have been actually about, but instead it was sort of whether the nine justices on the Supreme Court felt like they wanted to protect the rights of transgender children, their parents, their doctors, or not. Joining us now is Chris Geidner, award-winning veteran legal journalist, author of the LawDork.com newsletter site, formerly the legal editor at BuzzFeed News, and editor-in-chief of the Ohio State Law Journal, as well as a contributor to the New York Times and elsewhere. Chris Geidner, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
So great to talk with you today.
I got to tell you, before we get into the legal weeds of this case, Chris, it kind of just makes me sad. I mean, it feels like it's awful. It's cruel. It is only political. It is not about protecting children. It's about hurting them. I know there are kids, minors, who are really being hurt by this law and by laws like these in 25 other states. And then, you know, from what I could glean from Wednesday's hearing, you got creeps like Justice Brett Kavanaugh sort of, you know, jumping off the screen of Fox News to ask whether the plaintiffs here representing these minors, who are told that they can't get help from doctors, whether they believe that transgender athletes have, quote, a constitutional right to participate in girls' sports. Now, unless I am missing something, and I didn't get to follow the full hearing where you did, it seems to me the case actually has nothing to do with its rights to participate in girls' sports. Am I misreading, misunderstanding that, or were a number of these right-wing justices sort of using this case to beat their own personal political activist drum, with their views on transgender people and transgenderism as a whole?
I don't know if I'd quite go as far as you're going with regard to Kavanaugh. I definitely would say that as to Alito. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why I would differentiate those is that S.J. Preliger and Chase Strangio's responses to the anti-trans playbook questions from Alito, mm-hmm, and those questions from Kavanaugh were different. The things that Alito raised about European studies, yes, the Cass report, things like that, that really were literally like out of Fox News chirons, mm-hmm, they pushed back. They said, one, those are inaccurate. Two, there's no wholesale bans on trans care in Europe. Mm-hmm. And three, none of that was in the record at the district court when it considered it. So even if you want to consider those things, send it back to the trial court. What they said when Kavanaugh raised sports is that's a different interest. Mm-hmm. That's not this case. And that was an acknowledgement that if the court does hold that laws that target trans people often, if not always, are going to be sex-based classifications and are subject to heightened scrutiny, or in the area that Justice Kagan and Justice Barrett delved into, if transgender status standing alone is subject to heightened scrutiny. Either way, that would apply to challenges to sports bans. And so it was a legitimate question, the sort of hypotheticals that justices ask at oral argument. Now, I think that S.J. Prelogar and Chase were excellent at advocating for what they want to be the result in this case by saying, that's a different case, that's different interests. Mm-hmm. Those, I think, Prelogar went a little further than Chase did in suggesting, like, possibly those could be upheld in light of those different interests, whereas Chase was very direct and said, those are different state interests, and that would be in that case. Now, based on Chase's arguments in those cases, he thinks that those states can't make out heightened scrutiny justifying sports bans either, but that's for another case.
Well, let's focusing on this case. And the reason I was, you know, okay, I see what you're saying, that this could apply to further cases down the road. That said, you know, it seemed like ultimately this case, the one that was at the court on Wednesday, is about whether the Sixth Circuit, the court, the lower court, actually decided it, heard it correctly in the first place, which is the reference that you made to heightened scrutiny and so forth. So just to be clear about that, can you explain it to me like I'm a three-year-old, which I sometimes am when it comes to issues of law, what the difference is between heightened scrutiny and rational basis? Because they're saying it was heard on a rational basis at the lower court. It should have been heard on a heightened scrutiny basis. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. And the simple way of thinking about this is that we have generally, when legislatures pass laws, we presume that they're valid. That's just like, that's how the system works.
Okay.
And that's rational basis. But over time, courts realized that there are some times that the balance should not start out that uneven. we have learned over time that when laws classify groups of people and make different treatment of the laws based on those classifications, we should look at them a little more skeptically. And the top version of that is racial classifications get what's called strict scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And that means that in all but the rarest cases, it is going to be unconstitutional. You need to prove that there's a compelling state interest for your classification and that you have narrowly tailored your regulation to that interest.
Let me just underscore that, because I think it's important. So strict scrutiny, because it might be something that could potentially violate some of our most sacred rights, you know, racial discrimination and so forth. If we're going to do that, we have to basically prove that the government has a very important interest in doing so for any, you know, reason of security or whatever else. Yeah.
And that this is, and that the law that you've passed is actually very narrowly tailored to do that. You're not over-inclusive. You're not capturing people under that law who don't help you meet that interest.
Okay. And the argument here that seems
then
to,
there's a middle group.
Okay. Okay.
And that's intermediate scrutiny, and that's sex-based classifications. And what that's saying is that over time, courts realized that, wait, these all of these laws that classify based on sex aren't necessarily fair. They're not based in anything that government needs to do. And so you they created this intermediate scrutiny that isn't quite as searing as strict scrutiny because, as justices have said in various opinions, there are times when we want to treat the sexes differently, and there are good reasons for it. And so what states need to prove when they have a sex-based classification is that there's an important government interest and that the law is substantially related to it. Now, that sounds like a bunch of just like it's words, but what it really means in like you're a three-year-old, as you said.
Yes, thank you.
Like, you need to have a reason.
Right.
And like the law has to look like you actually created a law that relates to advancing that reason.
And how was this case then heard? Was it the heightened scrutiny, the intermediate scrutiny, the rational basis at the lower court? Yeah.
When the district court, both, this case was originally at the Sixth Circuit. It was heard also with a challenge out of Kentucky and to Kentucky's similar ban. And the district court judges in both of those cases applied heightened scrutiny. They said this likely classifies based on sex and based on transgender status. Mm-hmm. And either way, these laws are not closely tailored to the health and safety interest that they're claiming.
Okay.
When it got to the Sixth Circuit, Judge Jeffrey Sutton and Amol Thapar said, "We disagree. We do not think that this is a sex-based classification because it affects both boys and girls." Now, we'll get into how Justice Jackson thought about that.
Yes,
but that was their decision. And so because of that, they applied that rational basis. And they said, under rational basis, this law is likely constitutional.
That's the lowest.
It brought up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And all the DOJ and the ACLU representing the private plaintiffs were saying is, the Sixth Circuit got the wrong standard. Mm-hmm. All that you need to do is say the right standard is this is a sex-based classification and send it back for them to do the rest of this work.
Yes. And that seems to be the whole case in this case.
That could be the whole case. Now, because there was a district court decision that used heightened scrutiny, like the Supreme Court technically could apply either rational basis or heightened scrutiny and then go through and say where they think it falls. But they don't need to. And that was the point being made by both Preliger and Strangio.
And yet the Solicitor General from Tennessee was arguing that this has nothing to do with sex.
It's regulating medical procedures, and that's a normal state police power, and there's no reason why the court should even fathom that this could be a sex-based discrimination.
And it doesn't discriminate on sex because it affects both boys and girls totally equally. And that then was when KBJ, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, compared this case to 1967's Loving v. Virginia, in which the court decided unanimously at the time, again, those were the days, that state bans on interracial marriage were unconstitutional violations of the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the 14th Amendment. Here's a very short piece of that comment from Justice Jackson.
The law here operates in the same way. There, the question of can you marry this other person depended upon what your race was. You could marry the other person if it was the same, consistent with your race. You couldn't if you couldn't. I take your law to be doing basically the same thing.
Yeah.
You can get these blockers if doing so is consistent with your sex, but not if it's inconsistent.
And she also went along to note that, you know, at the time, before Loving v. Virginia, people would say, well, interracial bans on interracial marriage were not discriminatory because they affected both black people and white people equally. That seems like the same argument that Tennessee is trying to make now. There's no sex issues here. It just affects everybody.
Yeah, it really did. show the shallow pool of the argument that Tennessee has, because he really did have to stick to this idea that as I pointed out in my piece, mm-hmm. is just like belied by the very facts of the text of the law itself, in saying that this turns entirely on medical purpose, not a patient's sex, when the law literally says that what is banned is determined by knowing whether the procedure helps, quote, a minor to identify with or live as a purported identity inconsistent with the minor's sex.
Yeah, sex does seem to have something to do with this case.
And that was Kagan's. Kagan is Justice Kagan is very good at getting the line of the day.
Yeah.
And she did. And she said it's a dodge to say that this is not based on sex. It's based on medical purpose, when the medical purpose is utterly and entirely about sex.
Right. OK. And then playing into this is the Bostock case ruling from just 4 years ago, the 2020 case that Neil Gorsuch. Yes, the Trump-appointed Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion for, where he and Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's then four liberals in ruling in favor of transgender rights. Can you explain that case very quickly, and how or why or if it matters in the Tennessee case that was heard on Wednesday?
Yeah, so Bostock is this case that had sort of been circulating in the courts, in the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, for the entire decade before that. And the outcome in that case versus what we saw yesterday is clear a sign of how far this has gone afield of law mm-hmm. and into politics.
Mm-hmm.
Because there basically was no real argument from as early as 2012 that the issue decided in Bostock, which is that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, its ban on sex discrimination, that it includes discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. And the opinion by Justice Gorsuch for the court, as you said, is very straightforward, a textualist reading that says it doesn't matter what the lawmakers might have thought in 1964, or if they even knew trans people,
mm-hmm.
because the law itself, by its text, protects them, because in order to discriminate against a transgender person, at the base of that is mistreatment on the basis of their biological sex, because they are not acting how you believe somebody of their biological sex assigned at birth should be acting.
And ultimately that meant that you, just in stark terms, you can't fire someone, for example, because you find out that they're a transgender person.
Yeah.
So,
and
that was written by Neil Gorsuch. He wrote the majority opinion in that case.
It was by Justice Gorsuch, and he was, as you said, joined by Chief Justice Roberts
uh-huh.
and the then four liberals. And there was a very aggressive dissent from Justice Alito, that the majority of the page numbers of his dissent were made up of him literally just citing all of the different laws in the federal laws that include the word sex. This idea that you're opening Pandora's box, interpreting sex in all of these laws this way.
Oh, God.
Which, of course, is just reasonable.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Like there's nothing. And so how that relates to yesterday's case, the fact that, and I thought that Solicitor General Preligar did a really good job of explaining this, is that the only reason that this matters for this case is that Justice Gorsuch explained how you look at the word sex. And so when you are looking at It has nothing about how you apply it. It has nothing to do with the ins and outs of how you make a Title VII claim in court. It has nothing to do with the exceptions. But what it has to do with is when you see the word sex, what does it include? And that's not going to change in different laws, because the word sex is still the word sex. Yeah. And if you are discriminating against or classifying trans people, you are doing so because they are acting in discordance with their sex assigned at birth.
And
so that is why basically S.G. Preligar and Chase are saying in court, like, you want to use Bostock to understand that this ban on gender-affirming care for minors and this equal protection clause challenge under the 14th Amendment, which bans sex discrimination under the equal protection clause, should look at sex the same way for that first step of deciding whether there is a sex-based classification. Then you can get into the same sort of those tiers of scrutiny that we discussed,
yeah,
and you can do that the same way you would for anything else. It doesn't guarantee anything, but it is an understanding of how you define and interpret sex itself.
And again, what they're asking, what the challengers are asking here, is simply send the case back down to be reheard, I guess, at the Sixth Circuit. Because it's clearly based on sex, and they might still lose at the Sixth Circuit,
right,
and the case may come back up here, and then you can get into some of these further issues. But it was very curious that Gorsuch, who usually has no problem speaking up quite a bit, you know, with very pointed questions at these hearings, that he stayed completely silent.
Yeah, it was
on
weird.
Wednesday.
I'm just going to say it was weird. It's not quite clear. I think we should note that. So the Biden administration did take Bostock and said that early in Biden's administration, that basically look at this opinion, agencies, and see how it applies to your work. And one of the agencies that did that was the Education Department and its Title IX rules for sex discrimination in education. And it passed these rules, and they've been challenged in all of the states that passed gender-affirming care bans as well. And when that got up to the Supreme Court on the shadow docket, it should be noted that Gorsuch still joined the three Democratic appointees in voting to allow DOJ's request to, like, apply most of the rule while the litigation was ongoing. So it wasn't the same thing, but it did suggest that he does feel pretty strongly about these concepts. And him not saying anything yesterday could have been as simple as, I mean, a best case scenario for trans people is he knows where he is on this, and he was leaving it to other justices to talk.
Well, it seems to me that they would have to, that both Gorsuch and Roberts would sort of have to change their position in order to find against the challengers in this case. Is that?
Well, I think what we saw from Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh, who were most closely aligned, was this attempt to sort of come up with a way of resolving the case that would allow these laws to exist that isn't anti-trans, which essentially can only happen by turning the Equal Protection Clause on its head, or rendering it virtually irrelevant. I mean, Roberts kept talking about, like, the nuances of this evolving medicine. And now, to their credit, S.G. Preligar and Chase Strangio's response was, well, that's part two. Like, that has nothing to do with whether there's a sex classification.
Right.
That can, and there was a really good answer at one point from Preligar to Justice Kavanaugh specifically that said, like, you can write a very narrow decision here. that says this is a sex classification. Go back. You can even add your views on how lower courts
right.
should look at evolving medical evidence, should look mm-hmm. at, should defer to state legislatures, should mm-hmm. handle sports bans, look at them differently, like whatever you want to do.
Whatever you want to do, but
Kavanaugh, you can do it, but that's all in part two.
But, exactly, but just send it down for a rehearing at the lower court.
And so I'm not quite clear exactly how they get through that position to where they seem to want to be without either ignoring the Equal Protection Clause or with sending it back.
Yeah.
Which is why, I mean, like, if you look at my report, is not as skeptical as many others, is not as negative mm-hmm. as many others.
True.
And there's a few reasons for that. Like, one, I would challenge those people who were so sure of the outcome from yesterday to explain how they gather Justice Barrett's vote. I think she was far less clear in her position than Alito, who was clearly a walking Fox News Chiron.
Of course. And Thomas as well.
Thomas was he was a little weird, honestly. I mean, he asked some questions that were not great questions for Praligar or Strangio, but he was not, he did not have the antipathy to the challengers that he exhibits in other cases.
Well, I would, Chris, I would
be. Left-wing causes are raising issues.
Yeah, I would be stunned if he didn't go along with Tennessee here.
But like, he was not a firebrand
okay.
yesterday.
All right. Well,
I'm comfortable with journalists who place him on the side of upholding the bans.
Uh-huh.
But that only gives us four votes, even if Roberts and Kavanaugh are somehow find a way that they can justify being with them. Like, you still need either Barrett
right.
or Gorsuch vote.
Well, by the way, you'll get a prize at the end of this in June or July if Thomas ends up siding against the state.
The other thing is I don't think journalists should pave the way for bad decisions
okay.
from the court.
Fair enough.
Like, make them do their work.
Okay.
Like, if they're going to say it in arguments, it's fair for journalists to say it. And
okay.
I certainly didn't say they're likely to be struck down. I didn't even say it's likely to go back to the Sixth Circuit. But it comes down to Gorsuch and Barrett because it comes down to Gorsuch and Barrett. And I think that journalists who, the vast majority of my colleagues who said it looked like they're going to uphold the ban, like show me what Justice Barrett said that tells you that.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that bothered me about all the coverage. Every headline, other than yours, by the way, every headline seemed to be, doesn't look good, it looks like the court's conservatives are going to side against the challengers. Let's find out. There is
you
one...
always have to count to five.
There,
that's the
yes.
first and last rule of the Supreme Court. And yeah, you've got four bad votes. I've got that. I understand.
But you need the fifth.
You need five.
I'm going to point people to your coverage, of course, at Law Dork. Chris Geidner with Trans Care and Lives in the Balance, Justices Debate Tennessee Ban. You'll get much more there. And fascinating case, even if, as I said, as I started out here, it feels to me sad and cruel. And I'm bothered by the fact that we're just...
It's awful that we're even there.
Yeah.
Like, regardless of what happened.
Yeah.
The fact that, like, LW, you should read Casey Park's piece in the Washington Post today. LW was in court, the lead plaintiff, this trans girl who had to sit there and watch her government be fighting to prevent her from being able to receive the care that gave her the only joy that she had since she started puberty.
It's horrific. It's sad. It's cruel. It's maddening. And, well, Anyway, thank you for covering it. Thank you for sitting through a 2.5-hour hearing on it and sharing it with us. I'll point folks to your report over at lawdork.com, where they should sign up for your newsletter. That you can also be found on, I think you're over at Blue Sky now.
Mainly at Blue Sky.
There you
now.
Go. Wow. That's the spirit, at Chris Geidner over at Blue Sky. Chris, great speaking with you, my friend. We will be doing
you
it
too,
again
bro.
Soon. Thank you, sir. Okay, here, by the way, is I think we have, Des, part of that quote that Chris was referring to from Elena Kagan, making pretty damn clear that the Tennessee law is absolutely about sex and absolutely should be heard by the reheard by the Sixth Circuit under the proper scrutiny, proper heightened scrutiny because
yep.
of it, no matter how the court's right-wing justices may ultimately feel about the merits of Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for minors. The law is the law. The precedent is the precedent. Anyway, here's Kagan on that.
One of the articulated purposes of this law is essentially to encourage gender conformity and to discourage anything other than gender conformity. And I'm wondering how you think that plays into the analysis.
I disagree with that characterization
of
our law.
Well, encourage minors to appreciate their sex and ban treatments that might encourage minors to become disdainful of their sex. Sounds to me like we want boys to be boys and we want girls to be girls.
That's how the law reads. She's actually reading from the law there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this case is definitely about sex and it's, should be heard appropriately at the lower court on that basis.
Yeah, it's literally about enforcing gender conformity, gender norms.
Whether there are enough right-wing justices left on that court who believe in, you know, following decades-old precedent about such things, or whether they are now completely a right-wing activist court. Well, I want to say it remains to be seen, but I fear it's... been seen already in too many of their other recent rulings. But I'd love to be wrong. By the way, just before going on air, we were speaking to Chris Geidner off air. He's in Washington, D.C. But he noted that about, you know, an hour earlier or so, he was on air with a station in San Francisco when Thursday's 7.0 quake rattled the Bay Area and parts north. And he said they... in typical San Francisco fashion, they paused for a moment.
They did their alert.
And then they resumed coverage, asking him the next question. Because, you know, that's how they roll in San Francisco.
True professional.
Anyway, more on that quake and the tsunami warning that it triggered, plus Desi Doyen's Green News Report and a few things thereafter, if time allows, on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. A 7.0 magnitude earthquake shook a large area of Northern California and parts north on Thursday, about an hour or so before airtime here today, knocking items off of grocery store shelves, according to AP, sending children scrambling under desks and prompting a brief tsunami warning for 5.3 million people along the U.S. West Coast. Well, I am happy to say we were not among them. We're in Southern California and didn't feel a thing down
here. Just a little bit further away.
Yeah, but so for now, anyway. So thanks to those folks who did write in to check up on us, though I bet there were a bunch of folks in our listening area up in Northern California and Oregon and so forth who did feel the trembler today. The quake struck west of Ferndale, a small city in coastal Humboldt County, about 130 miles from the Oregon border. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, it was felt as far south as San Francisco, some 270 miles away, where residents reportedly felt a rolling motion for several seconds, followed by some smaller aftershocks. Happily, there were no immediate reports of major damage or inquiry. I have yet to see any such reports. Have you, Desiree?
I haven't.
You have not. And the tsunami warning afterwards was called off, thankfully. After about an hour, it was issued shortly after the quake struck. And the tsunami warning covered nearly 500 miles of coastline from the edge of California's Monterey Bay north into Oregon. Quote, "It was a strong quake. Our building shook. We're fine, but I have a mess to clean up right now," said Julie Kreitzer, the owner of the Golden Gate Mercantile, a store packed with food, wares, and souvenirs that is the main attraction in Ferndale. "We lost a lot of stuff," she told AP, before adding, quote, "I have to go. I have to try and salvage something for the holidays because it's going to be a tough year." And then she hung up.
Oh, gosh.
Shortly after the quake, phones in Northern California buzzed with tsunami warnings from the National Weather Service. That's good, I guess, that the warnings were, you know, got out to everyone. The warning said, quote, "A series of powerful waves and strong currents may impact coast near you. You are in danger. Get away from coastal waters. Move to high ground or inland now. Keep away from the coast until local officials say it is safe to return." Yikes, that would have been scary to get one of those.
Yes, and you know, for people who haven't ever been in an earthquake, of course the really severe ones are quite terrifying, but I've only been in ones that are pretty mild, and they actually feel kind of like being on top of a washing machine that has gone out of balance, that kind of ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. So imagine a whole house with that, and you can get a sense of the damage that can be generated, even from a low level.
Well, from the earthquake, but it was kind of the tsunami warning that, I don't know, freaked me out. And, you know, after what we saw in Fukushima, I'll get to that in a second. But anyway, numerous cities urged people to evacuate to higher ground as a precaution, including Eureka, whose mayor, Kim Burgell, said that crews were assessing if there was any major damage from the quake. She works as a resource aide at a middle school. She said that the lights were swaying. Everyone got under their desks. She said, quote, "The kids were so great and terrified," which is a strange way to put that. "It seemed to go back and forth for quite a long time," she said. "Some kids asked, can I call my mom?" The students were later sent home, but everybody seems to be okay. The Humboldt County Sheriff said that residents experienced some cracks in their home's foundation, some broken glass and windows, nothing severe. There's been no major infrastructure problems reported or buildings collapsed or roadway issues.
Good.
No major injuries or deaths have been reported as of now, or at least as of an hour or so ago, according to the Humboldt Sheriff. And because this alert today, or at least this breaking news, went out to a lot of folks nationally, which is understandable after a 7.0 quake, pretty big, and a subsequent tsunami warning. And since we're here in California and got a lot of listeners on the West Coast, I just wanted to let you know that everyone seems to be okay. For folks who are not on the West Coast, the tsunami warning coordinator for the Tsunami Warning Center in, do you know where it is? The tsunami? It's in Alaska. He said that the computer models indicated that this was the type of quake that was unlikely to cause a tsunami. And once they figured that out, they called off the warning. The California Geological Survey says the state's shores have been struck by more than 150 tsunamis since 1800. And while most are minor, some have been destructive and deadly. But it is interesting. It seems to me that since the earthquake and horrific tsunami off of Fukushima in Japan back in 2011, that killed, by the way, at least 20,000 people and caused a serious nuclear plant disaster meltdown there. It seems to me that since then, a lot more folks seem to be aware of the dangers of tsunamis and the damage that they can do after an earthquake. I think the earthquake off of Japan at the time back in 2011 was 9.0, if I recall. I remember watching that one roll ashore live on television as it happened. And in that case, the waves were reportedly as high as 133 feet.
Yikes.
That quake in 2011 actually caused about $100 million damage in California, along the California coast, which is how bad that one was. But everyone, anyway, for the moment, appears to be okay. We are in a bit of an earthquake drought down here in Southern California, where we haven't had any big ones in about 30 years. But I'm sure everything will be fine for another 30 years or so, right? Hey, speaking of droughts, another kind of drought out here. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
The survival of my people and so many others is on the line.
Top UN court to rule on landmark climate change case.
We want Duke Energy Corporation to be held accountable for the damages to human lives and town property.
North Carolina town sues utility Duke Energy over climate deception. Plus, global warming now the dominant driver of drought in the U.S. West.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
While the United States federal government under Donald Trump may put climate action on the back burner, the work to contain climate change is going to continue in the United States with commitment and passion and belief.
That is a load of hot air. When President Trump left office, emissions in this nation were the lowest that they had been since 1950 because of the use of natural gas.
No, they were the lowest since 1950 because of the pandemic, you Fox News jackass. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I'm going to try to cool down while you do the green news here, but more temperature records for November.
Yep, November 2024 was the second hottest November ever recorded since record keeping began in the mid-1800s.
Does Fox News have an explanation for that?
No.
I'm sorry. Continue, please.
It was second only to last November. That's according to Europe's climate service Copernicus. That means that 2024 will be the warmest year ever recorded. In the United States, this autumn will also likely be the warmest ever recorded, with average temperatures in the lower 48 more than 7 degrees above normal.
For some reason, I suspect Fox News won't be reporting that news.
A new study finds that global warming, driven by the burning of fossil fuels, has become the dominant force behind worsening drought in the western United States. The researchers found that while droughts in the 20th century were caused mainly by declines in precipitation and natural cycles, hotter temperatures from global warming are driving drought in the 21st century, increasing the length, intensity, and the range of areas affected by drought conditions. The study authors say the severity of future droughts will be determined largely by how much more climate warming gases humans release into the atmosphere.
Oh, I bet we're going to be releasing a lot.
In other news, in South Africa, in a landmark decision, the country's high court rejected the government's plan to build new coal-fired power plants,
good,
ruling that the increase in pollution and emissions are unlawful and violate citizens' constitutional right to health.
Good.
Here in the U.S., the town of Carrboro, North Carolina, has sued Duke Energy.
Also good.
One of the nation's largest utility companies, accusing it of deceiving the public about the harms of man-made climate change. The suit alleges that Duke Energy knew that burning fossil fuels causes climate change since the 1960s, but top executives increased the company's use of oil and gas, delayed the transition to clean energy, and spent millions of dollars lying to the public about the causes and consequences of climate change.
Stunning.
The suit seeks compensation for millions of dollars in damages from floods and other extreme weather disasters.
Finally, the world's biggest climate case is underway at the International Court of Justice at The Hague to consider what countries around the world are legally required to do to combat climate change and repair damages, and what are the legal consequences if they don't. The case was brought by a coalition of more than 100 countries, led by Vanuatu and low-lying island nations, now facing an existential crisis of rising sea levels and weather disasters in, quote, a system we did not create. The petitioners say a handful of wealthy, polluting nations should be held legally and financially responsible for the accelerating impacts of man-made global warming. Vanuatu's special envoy for climate, Ralph Reginvanu, said the court's proceedings will reverberate across generations.
I choose my words carefully when I say that this may well be the most consequential case in the history of humanity. Let us not allow future generations to look back and wonder why the cause of their doom was condoned. The conduct on trial here is that of states, which have failed for over a century, despite increasingly dire warnings, to rein in the emissions from their territories.
While the court's decision would not be legally binding, it could give extra weight to climate liability lawsuits all over the world.
Well, the incoming Trump administration can start ignoring it now. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, including Blue Sky, at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Vanuatu, Vanuatu.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
The land where we belong.
I love that tune. It does seem to me, Des, that thank you very much for that. It seems to me that Vanuatu has been sort of punching well above its weight for several years now in this climate fight.
Yeah, pretty much all of the Pacific Island nation states, they're all low-lying, and to varying degrees, they will be affected by sea level rise. There's one small island called Kiribati. It's spelled Kiribati, but it's actually pronounced Kiribati.
Yeah.
And they will be completely inundated and lost.
Disappear, wiped off the map.
Beneath the seas if we don't move faster to rein in emissions. And it's unclear whether they can be saved at all. But they have actually bought land in Fiji in order to start relocating their residents because saltwater intrusion from rising sea levels is already contaminating their groundwater from underneath. They've also contracted with New Zealand. New Zealand is allowing them to move about 150 people a year to relocate there, but that's out of 112,000 people, so that's going to not necessarily take care of everybody.
Well, no wonder those island nations are fighting like hell to force countries like the U.S. and China to do the right thing and knock it off, basically.
Whole cultures will be lost.
Yep. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or want to listen again, share it with a friend, a family, a neighbor, an enemy, you can do so downloading it for free anytime at bradblog.com, made possible by those of you who hit a donate button when you go there or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com and on the social medias, yes, including Blue Sky, especially Blue Sky. You will now find me at The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Vanuatu, Vanuatu, the land where we belong.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.